So tonight is going to be a bit of a throwback, sort of a look at the way meditation was taught maybe 20 years ago, sort of a map as it was presented. It's a little bit like, I was thinking about a talk that Philip Moffitt gave about 15 years ago, and it's going to be similar to that in structure, but it'll also give us a chance to sort of look at some of the new influences and new ideas that have been coming in lately, how they've influenced our practices. And 20 years ago, there weren't that many Dharma books out. There were a few by people like Joseph Goldstein and Jack Kornfield. But if you go back to 1965, there were almost none. And this was a book, this is The Heart of Buddhist Meditation by Nyanaponika Thera, which is a great classic. It's on a lot of people's bookshelves here. Different people react to it differently. Philip Moffitt taught a retreat about 15 years ago. It was a great retreat, very small, intimate. It was only experienced people and only Sangha members, but this was required reading for the retreat. And there are texts since then that have superseded this, but this is still a terrific book. Nyanaponika Thera, a German-born monk who lived and translated in Sri Lanka and died, unfortunately, too young of a heart attack. He was in the middle of a major translation project. Anyway, there's some interesting stories about this that I probably won't get around to. But he lays out sort of some standard behaviors that have since been not entirely replaced by other approaches, but certainly influenced by others. So to back up a little bit, our basic goal is what we call, or what we're basically doing here, is something that we call mindfulness practice. And the goal of mindfulness practice is to know the truth of our experiences as they arise in each moment. And this leads to a certain kind of wisdom and to a certain kind of insight, which leads, ultimately, we hope, to full liberation. But even if we don't get to full liberation, just knowing the truth of our experience as it's happening is a wonderful experience and could teach us a great deal. So to cultivate mindfulness, we do meditation practices that break down into two fundamental categories. And this is a little bit artificial. I'll get back to that in a little bit. The categories are concentration practice or samatha. The Sanskrit word for samatha is samadhi, which people are more familiar with. You see, you know, samadhi, and oh, you want samadhi, this is the luxury car for you. Samadhi shows up a lot in popular culture. Samatha, not so much. We don't do Pali in popular culture. And then the second major category is vipassana. I'm mispronouncing it, I know, or insight meditation. And there's a lot of opportunity for confusion here because we often say mindfulness when we actually mean insight practice and vice versa. They actually are different, but I've caught myself using them interchangeably as well. But these are sort of two pieces, and I'll talk a little bit more about how they relate, how we do them, how we don't do them if we can't or don't want to. So I'll start with samatha practice. Concentration practice. And concentration is a really unfortunate translation because it kind of implies compression or tightening or squeezing the attention, narrowing the attention onto something like the breath. And what people have discovered, particularly more recently, is that especially for Westerners, this is not very productive. It tends to produce a lot of stress, a lot of conflict, a lot of, am I doing it right? I must be doing it wrong. I'm not there yet. Everything is supposed to go away except the breath or whatever it is that I'm supposed to be concentrating on. So it tends to be quite hard to do. Turns out that for most people, certainly for me, not everybody, but for most people, relaxed attention is a lot more effective. Just staying relaxed. It's amazing how much you can do to get focused, to steady the mind with just the slightest effort. That's why in the guided sit I talked about, see if you can do this with less effort. Whatever amount of effort you think is required, can you do it with less? Just because that relaxation has been, for me and for many people I know, so, so helpful. And other ideas like keeping the breath in the foreground and other things in the background. I used to think that if I had any thoughts or physical sensations, I was doing it wrong, because I was supposed to be so concentrated on the breath that everything else just fell away. Of course, it doesn't work like that for most people at most of the times. It can. I'll talk a little bit more about that. So the Buddha did not invent samatha practice. It goes way back. I suspect that it goes back to the very earliest times of human beings when they started to just do things that were a little bit beyond the other primates. For one thing, there is a kind of delight that we experience when we do certain tasks that absorb us, like painting. We have a friend who's a painter, and we were in a sitting group with her for a while, and she said, well, you know, meditation is nice, but I don't see why I need meditation because I've got painting. And she had a very good point. She knows, as anybody who does painting or sculpture or certain other tasks, that when you're in the middle of painting or that creative act, a lot of other stuff, worry, fretting, tends to go away. That's one of the things that makes it so refreshing. So I think ancient peoples must have been very curious, and we know that they were curious, and they must early on have discovered the joy of focusing on making a stone tool, on just spending all that time creating these really beautifully done pieces of ancient technology. So, being curious as they were, they probably wondered what would happen if they just paid attention to other things that were less interesting than carving a stone tool. As some of you know, I used to work as a computer programmer and then as a manager of programmers. And I was working at a startup in the city, and one of the people working for me was also a founder of the company. So it was a little weird because he was my boss and I was his boss at the same time. Plus, he was an old friend. But I came in on a Sunday afternoon to get some work done, and he had been there all weekend. And he said he'd been there living on takeout pizza, hadn't showered, hadn't shaved, had slept only a couple of hours a night, and he felt great. And I envied him. Because I remembered, I was a manager, so I couldn't really put my hands on code anymore. But I envied him because I remembered what it was like to be so engrossed in problems that everything else falls away. So it's worthwhile to talk here about papancha mind. Papancha is a Pali word, Pali being the language that the Buddha's teachings was first written down in, not the language he spoke. He spoke probably Magadha, but Magadha and Pali are both vernaculars of Sanskrit. It's a very similar languages. Papancha mind, the word papancha translates literally to proliferating. And I think that's a pretty good translation, because this is the mind where thoughts just seem to spontaneously arise and lead to other thoughts and lead to yet other thoughts. You've probably noticed this if you've tried to do any meditating at all, is that, you know, you find your mind has wandered, and if you actually try to trace it back through all the little leaps of story, it can be really entertaining. Most teachers, by the way, say, don't do that. You know, just go back to the breath. But I find it's kind of educational to look and entertaining and kind of fun to look back at how you got there. And then when I finally do go back to the breath, I've had a good laugh. And so I go back to the breath with kind of a more positive attitude about it. Like, oh my God, where was I? So there's actually a pleasure in letting go of that whole train of thought, that whole train wreck of thought, and go back to the breath. So proliferating mind is generally about planning, worrying, remembering, fantasizing. It's just all this stuff that the mind likes to do to entertain itself. And so when you do something like writing code or chiseling a stone tool, you're getting some relief, just a brief vacation from papancha mind. So we see why meditation could have occurred to people quite early on in our development, particularly concentration practice. So samatha practice is where we aim our attention at an object and try to keep it there. Obviously, it's going to wander off and we keep on coming back, and that's fine. It's like you're trying to train a puppy. You don't hate the puppy. You don't get mad at the puppy. You know, you try to do what's best for the puppy. Your mind is like a puppy wandering off in the tall weeds. So, you know, you follow after it and you try to take care of the puppy. So the object of our attention could be a number of things. And I want to touch on other practices just because we tend to get really focused on the breath, on the breath in Theravada tradition, which is fine. But there are a lot of other practices that can be very rewarding. There are chants, mantras. Transcendental meditation teaches using mantras, and that's a very effective concentration practice. Works quite well for a number of friends of mine. Visualization is used in a lot of practices, particularly Vajrayana, which is the branch of Buddhism that we think of as Tibetan Buddhism, but it's also prevalent in, of all places, Mongolia. It's the principal religion of Mongolia. Bhutan, Sikkim, Ladakh, India, all along the Himalayas, and again, Mongolia. Visualizations can be very elaborate. You can spend time visualizing and chanting about a particular bodhisattva, which you could think of as a deity, like Manjushri or Green Tara. I might mention Manjushri later on. Interesting character. Another form of visualization in Vajrayana practice is, you may have seen some of these mandalas that look like geometric patterns. If you look at them closely, you'll realize that they're actually maps from above of temples with gates in the four principal directions. And one of the visualization practices is to visualize this temple so effectively that you can actually enter the temple in your imagination and describe it to a teacher and interact with your teacher there. These are difficult practices. And they're not for everybody. Stephen Batchelor, who's a scholar who now practices primarily Theravada, spent 10 years as a Vajrayana monk in Switzerland, I think. And he spent 10 years doing visualization practices, and he says that when he finally sat down and went to a Vipassana retreat and followed the breath, it was like, oh, wow, that's great. It worked for him in a way that the visualization practices just didn't. Now, they do work for a lot of people, so I'm not putting them down. Another object of meditation is sound. And there are a couple of flavors of this. One is the neti sound, which is, if you sit very quietly, helps if it's in a quiet room, you can hear a high-pitched hum. It's like the circuitry in your brain just seems to have a hum all by itself. Ajahn Sumedho calls this the sound of silence, and he has spent many years following this as his object of meditation. This is not a good idea for people with tinnitus. And some people report it differently. Some people find it a high whine or a hum. Other people is kind of a buzzing. Sometimes it's easy to find. Sometimes it isn't. I find it too boring. If I find it, it's sort of like, now what? Then there's visual things like gazing at a flame, a candle flame, or looking at a mandala, not so much as a different mandalas do different things, by the way. There's visualization mandalas. There are other mandalas that are just for the focus of attention. And another interesting one is something called a kasina, which the Buddha did mention, but became much more important in later aspects of the Theravada tradition. And a kasina is simply a painted disc of some color. Just a plain disc. It'd be white, blue, brown. And the idea is to just look at the disc until you can completely visualize and make it absolutely manifest in the mind by itself. And I'm not doing this full justice because kasina is also taught in the context of jhana practice, which I'll mention in a little while. But the breath is used very commonly, not just in Buddhism, but other practices as well. And there's some good reasons for it. It's easy to find. And the neti sound can be hard to find sometimes. It's highly portable. You don't have to carry around a candle and matches. You don't have to carry around a mandala. You can just have it there in the swimming pool with you. The breath is always there. It's neutral in tone, meaning most of the time we don't have a lot of pleasant or unpleasant charge to it. And when things have pleasant or unpleasant charges, we're either grabbing after them or pushing them away. There's a lot of that push and pull going on for so much of our experience. But the breath for most people most of the time is pretty neutral. There are exceptions to that. There's a great Zen story I've told before. The novice goes to the teacher and says, "You've told me to focus on the breath, but the breath is really, really boring. It's just dull." So the teacher grabs the novice by the nape of his tunic or robe, plunges him into the water. They're standing next to a well, very handily, holds him there underwater for a few minutes, pulls him up. The novice says, teacher says, "How was that breath?" So yeah, I mean, after coming out of the well, the breath could be very, very pleasant. But most of the time, it's pretty neutral. And the other thing about the breath that makes it pretty interesting is it's like a bridge between the conscious and the unconscious. We can hold our breath. We can huff and puff. We can hyperventilate if we want to. But when we go to sleep, the breath doesn't stop. We can get knocked unconscious and the breath doesn't stop, we hope. The breath is one of those things that just keeps going for our whole life, whether we're conscious or unconscious. So it's one of those things that there's both the control aspect and the entirely unconscious aspect. These practices can show up in combinations. Our traditional metta practice, for instance, as it's generally taught, is a combination of mantra. We talk about may you be safe, may you be happy, may you be healthy, may you be at peace. And we visualize the recipient of the metta. So we've got visualization, we've got the mantra aspect, and we often naturally tie it in with the breath. Some teachers emphasize this, some don't. There's another practice that I ran into recently, reading a book, one of those books about the brain and all the brain research done with respect to meditation. And they had done some studies looking at brain waves of people doing a practice, a concentration practice that I call Devil Nanny. I'll explain why. I'm not doing it full justice, but what you do is you put your little finger and thumb together and you go sa, then the next finger ta, next finger na, and then the index finger ma, and you say these things out loud. So sa ta na ma, sa ta na ma, slower than that. You do that for 2 minutes, then you whisper it for 2 minutes. Then you do it silently for 2 minutes. And I think you stop doing the finger thing. Then you do it whisper for 2 minutes and then chant it out loud for 2 minutes. So it's quite short, but the interesting thing is you can get fairly concentrated fairly quickly doing it. Barbara and I were experimenting with this for a while. Very, very interesting. It's got a lot of metaphysical stuff attached to it. These are names of God, supposedly. But the people in this particular study were not told that. They were just given it as a concentration practice. So why do I call it Devil Nanny? This is a mnemonic. Sata, Satan, Satan, Ama. If you do crossword puzzles, you know Ama is an Asian nanny. So the Devil Nanny meditation practice. Don't tell any Hindu or Vedantic people that I used that mnemonic. It would not help my case. So this is actually effective. So why don't we teach things like this? Why don't we go with that? And my theory, after thinking about it, is that, well, it's more than a theory, is that practices like this, or even things like painting or sculpting or writing computer code, are a little bit like a training wheel on a bicycle. You can get up on the bicycle and get a feeling for what it's like and learn quite a bit about what it's like to ride a bicycle. And you can do a lot quickly, but you're not going to go terribly deep with practices like that. So why samatha practice? I mean, by now, a lot of the things I'm going to say are things that you know already or you wouldn't be here. And meditation has become a big, hot topic in the general world. You see lots of things about how great meditation is. We know that it reduces blood pressure, it reduces stress, it increases feelings of well-being. Interestingly, it also seems to improve cognition. So that's pretty good. And again, it's a vacation for the pancha mind. Even the milder methods like painting and sculpture gives you a vacation from the monkey mind. So samatha can be very rewarding, and there are whole traditions based entirely on what we call concentration practice. But to take it a little bit further, samatha practice builds the steadiness of mind that enables to aim and sustain our attention on things other than the breath. Okay, big fanfare here. I mean, other than the breath. I mean, it seems kind of obvious. I mean, we're not doing this samatha practice to become experts in the breath. So we can actually focus on things that are not all that interesting or things that we prefer to avoid, like, you know, meetings, lectures from our boss, phone calls with our brother-in-law. So building this steadiness of mind is a training, and samatha practice is that training. It's like the way we build muscles by lifting weights. We build that attention to focus, to direct the mind by meditating. So just to recap, there are wonderful hints about how to improve one's samatha practice. And we, you know, most of us are experienced enough that we haven't heard them for a long time. But it's worthwhile going over a couple of them. And at the guided sit that we did tonight, part of this was we started by coming into the body and coming out of the coconut, dropping the attention out of the coconut into the felt physical sense of the body. This is a great start, just because the physical sensations of the body they're not deceptive. You will fool yourself with your thoughts, but your body, you can't fool your body can't fool you. We cultivate alert, relaxed attention. And something that I like to do, and I used to do this in our Back to Basics introductory course, which we will try to teach again sometime, probably next spring. So just take a moment and rest your hand on your thigh. Just drop your hand onto your thigh. Now really push down on your thigh. And notice how that feels both in the thigh and in the forearm. Let go. Now hold your hand up above your thigh. maybe doesn't feel like as much stress, but if you were to hold it there for half an hour, you would really notice it. So just let your hand back down on your thigh. I like to think of resting my attention on the breath the way my hand is resting on my thigh. Just completely relaxed. It's tricky because it still takes a little bit of volition to keep on coming back over and over again to that hand on the thigh, to the attention on the breath. There's some other tricks too. Some of them are quite fancy. Something that I still do a lot is tagging, just noticing in on the in-breath and out on the out-breath. Some people like rising, falling instead. Another one is counting, like counting one on the inhale, nothing on the out, two on the on the next inhale, three on the next inhale. Some people like to go to eight and then start over again. It's kind of interesting because if you find if you've lost count, then your focus was not as good as you thought it was. This is a good way. I will often settle down by just, when I first sit, I'll do counting for a while until I feel steadier and then let that go and go with the breath. Then there's some, and this is why it's really good to work with a teacher. I talked to somebody recently who said that he had had trouble. He was very good at staying focused on the inhale and focused on the exhale. But at the end of the exhale, there was a slight pause, and then his mind would wander off. And so he talked to a teacher who gave him the advice, between the exhale and the inhale, during that pause, turn your attention from the breath to your lips. And he said that worked great for him. I thought, wow, if I tried that, I would just get lost in thought, like, oh, when do I switch over? I should switch back now. But for him, this was a great practice. This worked really well. For me, I don't have trouble crossing the gap, if there even is one. But this is one of the reasons why it's so helpful to work with a teacher, is they can come up with solutions to certain issues that one might have in developing samatha. So samatha, besides, can lead to a number of experiences. I mean, obvious ones are calm, peace. You really can settle down with time and with experience. And then when concentration is quite strong, particularly on retreat, or if you've been doing this for a while and can settle down quickly, some people talk about the experience of being breathed rather than breathing. Or another one I've heard is being inside the breath. This is stuff that when you tell your friends this, they're going to think you're nuts. About 4 or 5 years ago, I was talking to Philip Moffitt, and we were talking about breath bodies and breath energy bodies. And he stopped all of a sudden and said, you know, there are a lot of people who, if they heard us right now, they would think we were nuts. And I said, you know, if the person I was 5 years ago had heard us, I would think we were nuts. And yet we were trying to establish a vocabulary for talking about our experiences. Not so easy. Something that a lot of teachers talk about as a phenomenon that develops with concentration, usually on a retreat, because it takes a while, it may take days for this to actually arise. And that's something that some teachers call the beautiful breath. Some call it the sweet breath, where all of a sudden the breath becomes pleasant and there's a physical sensation of pleasantness that becomes quite, well, subtle at first and then can become quite strong. And then the breath becomes very easy to follow just because it's no longer boring. And then we get to a state that teachers, even 30 years ago, called access concentration or neighborhood concentration. Some teachers say that these are two different states. Some people say they're the same state. I don't think it matters. I think if your concentration, if your samatha is that strong, it doesn't matter. Because some interesting things happen. The hindrances are said to be, and I quote, at bay, which means they're very attenuated. They're very weak. The hindrances, just a quick review, there are five of them. There's greed or lust or wanting or hope. Then there's hatred, aversion, the second one. They're, by the way, they're not numbered. I'm just trying to keep track with my fingers so I get the correct number of them. Aversion, hatred, dislike, just sort of, this isn't quite right, you know, that kind of feeling can be very subtle, very strong. Then there's agitation or worry or just jitteriness. It can be very subtle. And then another one is sloth and torpor. I think sounds very Victorian. I love that phrase, sloth and torpor. By the way, these are actually treated as two different things, even though they're lumped together into one hindrance, because you often treat them the same way. Torpor is like sleepiness, and it can be physical, and there may not be anything you could do about it. You know, you can try to get the energy up, but you should probably be getting more sleep. But it's a very physical thing, and there's no moral quality to it. Sloth is kind of a laziness. This is one that I have a lot of trouble with. I get really lazy. And this does have moral overtones to it, that you can actually decide not to be lazy. So sloth and torpor. That's four. The fifth one is doubt. What the hell am I doing here? This isn't working at all. I'm doing it wrong. This is working for everybody else, but not for me. I'm too smart for this. I'm too dumb for this. I'm too awful a person for this. But these all, in deep samatha, in deep concentration, these tend to not go away entirely, but they get very, very weak, very attenuated. There's an important crossroads here, according to the way meditation was taught 20 years ago. And I'll get back to this. Concentration practice, once you get to the access or neighborhood concentration state, the mind is very quiet. If you start saying to yourself, when I get to Maui, the first thing I do is I'm going to... You're not in access concentration if that kind of stuff is coming into your mind. You're still thinking. There's still thoughts. Decision-making, there's volition, and the hindrances are not entirely gone, but you're not thinking about what you're going to do on the first day of your vacation. So samatha practice, the concentration can lead at this point, beyond this point, to states that we call jhanas, or states of meditative absorption. So jhana practice, and I'll talk a little bit more about these states. Jhana practice was downplayed for a long time in the West. I didn't even hear about them until maybe 12 years ago, 13 years ago. And they were not really taught at Spirit Rock or at Insight Meditation Society. And what happened was that, well, first of all, people started reading more and being exposed to more teachings from more different teachers within the Theravada tradition and being more curious about what was going on. But another thing that was happening was that there were people on retreats at Spirit Rock, because Spirit Rock was doing month-long retreats, two-month-long retreats. IMS is doing three-month-long retreats. People would spontaneously go into these rather extraordinary states and go to their teacher going, what the hell is this about? And their teachers, some of the teachers didn't know anything about them, and other teachers knew but hadn't had the experience themselves. So these organizations had to start dealing with it. And part of it was that the people who got involved in founding Spirit Rock and IMS had learned from teachers who had somewhat downplayed or even discouraged jhana practice. Ajahn Chah, for instance, apparently, I heard from someone that if you really express an interest in jhana practice, he would teach you how to do it. But he didn't volunteer the information. And so most of the people who worked with him, like Jack Kornfield, came to the U.S. Not really knowing much about jhana practice. So, just a little bit about jhana practice. I'm going to skip over a lot here for lack of time, but I will give some pointers to where to go for more information. You see these descriptions of jhana practice all over the Buddhist discourses. It's almost like boilerplate. You keep running into it and say, oh yeah, this is first jhana, this is second jhana. There are 8 jhanas altogether. 4 of them are called the rupa jhanas. Rupa is the word for form, which in this context means, I think, body, because they're physical. They're not just being in a good mood and going to your happy place. These are physical experiences. Then there are 4, they're often called the arupa jhanas. With A in front of rupa, that means not form. The formless jhanas is what they're often called. And actually, they're not called jhanas at all in the suttas, in the discourses. But they're usually lumped together that way and often taught that way. So I'll use that terminology. So this is just the description of the first jhana. There is the case where a monk, quite withdrawn from sensuality, withdrawn from unskillful qualities, enters and remains in the first jhana, rapture and pleasure born from withdrawal, accompanied by directed thought and evaluation. He permeates and pervades, suffuses and fills this very body with the rapture and pleasure born from withdrawal. There is nothing of his entire body unpervaded by rapture and pleasure born from withdrawal. Sounds pretty good, doesn't it? I'll have what he's having. So, and I'm not going to read the other 3. They get better. But that sounds pretty good, doesn't it? And the arupa jhanas, the 4 formless jhanas, there are no descriptions of what they feel like in the suttas. Whereas there's a lot of material on what jhanas are like, a lot of similes in the suttas. So you just have to use your imagination on these formless jhanas. The first of them is called the dimension of infinite space. The second is the dimension of infinite consciousness. The third is the dimension of nothingness. And the fourth is the dimension of neither perception nor non-perception. So jhanas, there's some good things about them and some bad things about them. I know that when jhana teaching started becoming available in the West, people got very interested. So one of the positive things about jhana practice is that jhanas are said to be a wholesome pleasure. That is, they're extremely pleasant, and yet they don't involve chasing after worldly pleasures. Somebody once asked the Buddha, gosh, don't the monks and nuns have a tough time with the celibacy thing? Don't they miss the physical pleasures? And the Buddha said, no, not when they've got jhana. So, must be pretty pleasant. Another thing about jhana practice is it's said that when in the jhanas there are no hindrances, those 5 hindrances that I described, they are gone without a trace. So there is this absolute purity of mind. Now, at the end of a jhana experience, you're just an ordinary asshole again. All of your hindrances are back. Yeah. Another good thing that happens with jhana practice is there's tremendous steadiness of mind. I guess I should mention the five jhana factors, and all of these are present in the first jhana. There's what this translation said was directed thought. Philip Moffat likes the phrase aiming the attention, vitaka, aim the attention, vichara, sustaining the attention. This translator likes evaluation, others like applied thought. So it was, okay, that's around, you know, even in ordinary times, we're doing that all the time. Then there's piti, rapture or joy, sukha, happiness or pleasure. Piti is like an energetic quality. It can be very sparkly, bright, luminous, uplifting. It can also be very tiring. It can give you a bad headache if you do it a lot. And then there's sukha, which is described as happiness. Some translators like pleasure. Sukha is more of a sweetness. Sally Armstrong describes it as being floating in a sea of honey at sunset. You know, it's just much more laid back, much more relaxed. And then there's ekagata, which is often translated as single-pointedness or unification of mind. And I like unification of the mind because in these states, a lot can be going on, and yet the mind is completely unified. And it's hard to imagine what that's like unless you've experienced. But most of the time, our mind is kind of all over the place. Single-pointedness, I didn't like that because it's squinched down to one point. But Ajahn Sumedho likes to use the phrase, the single-pointedness that encompasses the entire universe. And I can subscribe to that. So the thing about being that single-pointed, that unified of mind, is that it produces this tremendous steadiness of mind for a while. So there are bad things about jhanas, too. This is one of the reasons I think some teachers have really downplayed them. And I'll touch on this some more in a little while. Jhanas can be, by their very nature, divisive, because some people find them fairly easy to get to and other people don't. So there's this sort of haves and have-nots kind of aspect to it. And a lot of teachers have referred to that and discouraged chasing after jhanas, partly because it can cause a lot of fretting. I have a friend who had a jhana experience on a retreat, and he went to tell his friend that he had a jhana experience, and then he realized that his friend had just gotten back from a monastery where he'd spent many months trying to achieve jhana, and my friend felt really bad afterwards because it had sounded like he was boasting to his friend who had done a lot more and not reached jhana. So that's a big problem right there. And because of that, there's kind of a big taboo on discussing jhana. So that's good because it means you don't get into this boasting thing, you don't get into this haves and have-nots. But on the other hand, it means that there's not much mutual support. I don't know of any jhana discussion groups or jhana work groups. It'd be kind of nice, but how would you establish such a thing? Then there are a couple of people, and I don't think I'm violating any confidence by saying this. There are some people who have bad moods after being in jhana. Aya Ananda Bodhi has reported this. Apparently, she would have these bad moods after jhana, and she just stopped doing jhana practice because of that. Now, some people argue that, of course, when you come back to the world of ordinary suffering, ordinary dukkha, of course you're going to be in a bad mood. I'm not sure that that's an adequate explanation, but jhana is doing something neurologically odd and different. It's some kind of biological thing that we have wired into us that we're able to tap into, which is kind of amazing when you think about it. Another aspect that's somewhat negative is that people get into obsessive pursuit of jhana. It sounds so great. You hear so many good things about it, and you can really get to be a wonk about jhana. You know, read all the books. More and more books are coming out. And so there are people out there. Philip has talked about people that he's run into that he calls jhana junkies. And then there are people who other meditators describe as bliss ninnies. I love that. That would be a good band name, wouldn't it? Mm-hmm. Bliss ninnies. So, for instance, I spent a number of years really chasing jhana. And when we go on retreat, Barbara always thinks that I'm cruising the jhanas, and that's not happening at all. But on a retreat not too long ago, I spent a lot of time in access concentration. My mind was really steady, and it was really nice, but I really wanted to experience jhana. And then I'd notice, oh, but there's greed, because the greed, I want jhana, that's greed. It's in the way. I got to fight against greed. Oh, no. So then I was in conflict about the greed, fighting against the greed. So I finally gave up on trying to get the jhana and just decided I would enjoy the access concentration because it's actually very, very pleasant being in this state. And I suddenly got curious and realized, gosh, the hindrances are almost gone. And I enjoyed this so much. For the rest of the day, I had this big grin on my face. And I actually had, it was a better experience than jhana possibly could have been, just in spending this time enjoying the fact that the hindrances were so attenuated. So a couple of points here. Curiosity versus goal orientation. With jhana practice, you get so wrapped up in this big goal. And what happened to me was, once I stopped chasing that goal and was just curious about what my mind was like in that state, I had a much better time. I had a great time. And jhana practice can be very goal-oriented. And then when you do that, you get into goal versus not reaching your goal. It produces conflict. It turns out the Buddha himself had mastered jhanas. It is said that he mastered jhana practice. He did all 8 jhanas before he was enlightened. And he realized that they did not lead to liberation. They did not lead to freedom. But even after he was enlightened, he did encourage them. He did teach them. He didn't make them a requirement, but he did encourage them. This experience of what we in this tradition call jhana shows up in other traditions as well. The Desert Fathers, an early Christian movement that, as the name implies, formed a monastic community or a set of monastic communities in the desert, mostly in the Sinai and in what today is Egypt. Very early on, before the Council of Nicaea even, 100 to 200 AD, their writings had a big influence on later Christian contemplatives. But obviously it's not influenced mainstream Christianity as much as meditation practice as taught by the Buddha has influenced Buddhist tradition. But they have quotes like they talk about one quote that I read, and I'm paraphrasing, is they talk about the fire that does, being filled with the fire that does not burn. To me, that sounds like a description of jhana practice. Another quote is, if you wish to be filled with God, you must be empty of yourself. And that doesn't sound, it could be related to jhana practice, but it also sounds a lot like what we call anatta, or no self, the experience of not self. So there are a lot of different approaches to teaching jhana practice. There's a lot more information available than there was 20 years ago. Unfortunately, that's led to some confusion because there are so many different approaches. Some of the books out there can be quite helpful. Some of the teachers out there can be quite helpful. There are teachers who have had a lot of success teaching jhana to Westerners, but their approaches don't necessarily work for everybody. I won't name names here, but I know that Philip Moffat went and spent a month at a retreat given by one of these teachers at IMS on the East Coast, and he didn't like it at all. He's quite unhappy with it. And other people have had similar responses. And this particular teacher and some other teachers have the attitude that their way of teaching jhana is the only correct way, that everybody else is a fraud or a hoax. So you get a lot of this. So some of the books out there can be quite good at describing one particular approach, but one size does not necessarily fit all. I do want to put in a plug for this book, The Experience of Samadhi, Richard Shankman. And one of the reasons I think it's so good is that it talks a lot about the various approaches to jhana practice. He has interviews with a lot of teachers, including teachers who downplay jhana practice and teachers who really focus on it. So he's got interviews with Jack Kornfield and Lee Brazington and a number of other, Sharon Salzberg. So this is a really good way of getting a sense of the various different viewpoints with regard to jhana practice. He also talks, if you're a wonk, you'll really like this, about what the suttas, what the original discourses say about jhana versus some of the later additions and interpolations, like from the Abhidhamma and the Suttamagga. And there's a lot of just really good suggestions for how to pursue it yourself if you're interested. And so this would be a great starting point. Another suggestion would be to go to a concentration retreat. These were unheard of 15 years ago at Spirit Rock and its predecessors. I think the first one was about 11 or 12 years ago, and they sort of bootlegged it in. They called it deepening your practice. They didn't want to use concentration in the title. So now they're a lot looser about it, and there are one or even two concentration retreats a year, and they tend to be very good. So I'd recommend them highly. So another thing to keep in mind is that there are a number of maps, and they are just maps. There are mental states that don't appear on the jhana map. And maps are always different. Somebody can draw you a map how to get to the Sangha tonight. And somebody else can draw you a map on the back of a napkin, and they can be quite different. Somebody can tell you, oh yeah, you turn left across from Andes. Somebody else says, you turn left at Bayview. They're not wrong, but they're different. And a map that works for you might not work so well for somebody else. I think teachers have generally agreed that concentration practice by itself is not a wisdom practice. It's not transformative. It doesn't lead to letting us know the truth of our experience. It can be a valuable tool, just as building concentration is a valuable tool for developing the ability to focus our mind on things even when we'd rather not. So back to access or neighborhood concentration. A lot of teachers classically have said that this is a good place to decide whether to do vipassana practice, wisdom practice, or jhana practice. And in insight meditation, in this practice, we're not trying so much to concentrate on the breath. We receive our experience, whatever that experience might be. And a lot of people say that this was the Buddha's unique contribution, that nobody else had been doing that before. And the classic approach to vipassana meditation is to start with samatha practice to develop steadiness of mind, and then so that we can keep our mind on phenomena without jumping away or grabbing forward. So the way it was taught, the way I first heard about it, was that when we're meditating on the breath and some experience becomes strong in our field of awareness, we move the attention to that experience. Whereas in concentration practice, we would normally stay with the breath. So we develop the ability to examine physical states and then even mental states. And eventually we can place our attention on thoughts. Sounds weird, but if you've been there, you actually know that it can be done. You can watch thoughts arise and pass away. And this was a standard approach to insight practice. But more approaches have come up more recently, like choiceless awareness. Now, this is a phrase that was bandied about back in the old days, but you can actually drop the idea of using the breath as an anchor and just follow phenomena rising and passing. I've been experimenting with this recently, and this gets very interesting. Just letting a phenomena arise, noticing a phenomena arising and passing, and not trying to stay with it, just letting it go, just acknowledging, like, oh, breath, ah, elbow, ah, memory, ah, pressure on foot. And it can actually be quite faster than that because you don't have to stop and say the words out loud. Choice of awareness can arise quite naturally, especially when the monkey mind is quiet, which is another reason why I think concentration practice fits well with this, is that when the mind is steady, you can just be with the arising and passing. And for some people, this is less thinky. Because when I do standard Vipassana, oh, my knee hurts, I'll turn my attention to the knee, it's very hard for me to avoid getting caught up in story about my knee. Just happens, no matter how hard I try. So then I go back to the breath, and why did I even go to the knee to begin with? The other thing that happens with choiceless awareness, with things arising and passing, is you really get an experience of anicca. It's the Pali word for impermanence, which is one of the fundamental truths of our existence, that things are impermanent. So having impermanence as an experiential event rather than as a concept can be very interesting. And it can be quite intense. It can be almost as if things are breaking down into pixels. I like that there's a feeling of pixelation, or there can be. This was not widely taught as a practice 20 years ago. Now it's quite common. There's a teacher, a Burmese teacher named Utejaniya, and my understanding is that he teaches a combination of this choiceless awareness along with being aware of your attitude towards your experience while you're aware of this arising and passing. Now, something that can happen with meditation when your mind is quite steady and you're not chasing after jhana is that non-dual perception can grow. And non-dual perception sounds very conceptual, but people can actually experience this where there is hearing without anybody doing the hearing, or seeing without anybody doing the seeing. And this is like experiencing anatta, the idea of no self, which as a concept is very wiggly and hard to grasp at times, but as an experience can be known. And lately we've seen retreats where they are awareness retreats, where we become aware of awareness, which 5 years ago that sounded like crackpot stuff to me. But I've actually been on a couple of awareness retreats, and on the last one I actually did have a sense of being aware of awareness and what the awareness was like. I won't go into details because I'm running out of time. But I think what's important for all of this in finding a balance of practices that works for you is curiosity. Curiosity, I think, is just key to an active, vibrant practice because everybody is different. These are all guidelines. These are maps. If you're not curious about where the map might take you or where it might fail to take you, you're just going to be looking at a piece of paper. So there's a lot of disagreement in the Theravada world about the proper balance between insight and concentration practices. Some teachers really think it's a bad idea to do any jhana practice and don't even go with concentration practice and go with vipassana practice or even choiceless awareness from day one. But there are other teachers who don't even start teaching vipassana practice until you've mastered all eight jhanas and then some other fancier stuff that scares the bejesus out of me. So there's a lot of variety. Interest, and of course, people have to discover what works for themselves. I know that people, I know several people who cannot do concentration practice at all because they have trouble with migraines. And the concentration practice, for some reason, increases the migraine. Now, interestingly, the Buddha never talked about insight and concentration as separate practices. He often talked about them in ways where it sounded like he was approaching them from one or another direction, but he thought of them as being a unified practice. And I want to emphasize, and I'm sorry to be going over time, I'm going to wrap this up quickly, no matter what the balance, concentration and insight practices are important because they are mutually supportive. You need concentration to build the steadiness of mind to stay with the arising experience of insight practice. But you need insight to overcome some of the obstacles to building concentration, like restlessness or anger or doubt. I've been on retreats where I tried to muscle my way through a hindrance, and it doesn't work very well. It works a lot better to, oh, anxiety's coming up. Take a look at what anxiety's doing in the body. What is the physical experience of anxiety? That would be a lot more fruitful than trying to just bluff your way through it. So I'm just going to end with a story, with an analogy. This is from Ajahn Buddhadasa. It's too good to skip past here. He talks about, he uses the metaphor of being near this beautiful river, this wonderful river. Think of that as enlightenment or liberation. You want to get there. It's hot weather. You're in Southeast Asia. You really want to take a dip in that river. But between you and the river is this huge thicket of vines and bamboo. How are you going to get through there? Now, if you had a razor blade, you could cut, and it's nice and sharp, and in about an hour, you could cut through one of those bamboo stalks. Or if you had a baseball bat, you could whack away at it, and you might knock down one of those stalks in about an hour. It's not going to work. What you need to get through the thicket is a parang, which is one of those Southeast Asian machetes. They're big, they're heavy, and they have a really sharp edge. And so it has the weight, and it has the sharp edge. The weight is like the concentration practice. The concentration practice gives you the power to cut through that thicket. The sharp edge is what gives you the discernment to cut through, to get to the liberation on the other side. So this is how the two practices support each other and how they go together.